Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Frank Culkin, 2969. I'm the attorney for Cody Innes and Linda Innes. Linda Innes is present today. Cody Innes just had brain surgery to mitigate the effects of his Parkinson's disease and is not recovered enough to come here today. Your Honor, Ms. Innes died on May 26, 2010. The specific legal facts of her case are unusual and discreet. She was not an employee. If she was an employee of WAO, this would have been a workman's comp case and it would have been resolved years ago. She was not a recreational rafter. She was a guide. If she was a recreational rafter, probably the release that's before us, before you today, would have been adequate. She was a guide in training. A guide in training is a term of art specifically used in the regulatory scheme that governs Colorado outfitters. She was attempting to complete a course that was required by state regulation to engage in a field of work. She wanted to be a river raft guide. She could not be a river raft guide without completing this program successfully. The regulations provide for a 50-hour course. This program was going to take approximately 30 days and probably significantly more than 50 hours. River raft guiding as opposed to recreational river rafting, being a customer, is an essential activity. There's a myriad of cases that say that going for a ride on a river raft is recreational and is a volitional activity that you can walk away from, and it's not an essential activity. However, and there's not case law on this, but I believe that this is a policy decision that you have to make. The act of becoming a guide and the act of being a guide is an essential activity. It's an essential activity for two different reasons. One, it's essential to the customers. The customers generally are people who have no knowledge of rafting. They get in a boat, they're under the supervision of the guides, and they're in the water for anywhere from an hour to 2 or 3 hours. It's a very dangerous activity. It's far more dangerous if the guides don't know what they're doing.
I have concerns with this argument, frankly, about essential, why it's an essential service, and I'm not... I understand your argument, but I guess I'm having trouble finding case law that supports it. Brush seems to be fairly strongly against you on this kind of case. I understand Ms. Innes wanted this job. I understand that you want river rafters in the guide. I think there's case law that says river rafting is not essential. I mean, we're talking about, you know, it really comes down to contracts of adhesion.
Correct.
And why is this a contract of adhesion? Why couldn't she go to, she didn't like the release, go to a different rafting company?
I think if she'd gone to any rafting company, they would have extracted a similar release.
What evidence in the record is there to support that?
I don't believe there is any, Your Honor.
Okay. So do you have a case? What's your best case on point for why this is an essential service?
Well, I think the Rowan case is the best case, but it's not exactly on point. It stands for the proper. Judge Daniels ruled that Rowan had a workman's comp case against his against the ski company that he worked for. He also had a case against Vail Resorts for the dangerous condition of the race course. Judge Daniels ruled that there was a contract of adhesion because Rowan would probably be fired if he didn't sign the release, which is almost certainly true. Judge Daniels, in dicta, and I stress, this is dicta, we don't know what Judge Daniels would have done if he had actually been faced with the situation that exists in this case. It was an aside, and I mean, I'm so old, I had Professor Marsh as my property teacher, and he said dicta is dicta, and that's what it is. I have certainly searched for a case exactly on point, and that's why I started this argument the way I did, is because I don't think there is a case exactly on point. The cases that discuss river rafting all discuss commercial customers. She is not a commercial customer. That's by state regulation. She was a trainee, and the job she was being trained for is an essential job to the safety of the customers. I mean, I don't think the fact that the recreational rafters can walk away from a job means that the training for the position that keeps the recreational rafters relatively safe is a non-essential task, non-essential area of interest. And it's an area of interest for the state government.
Mr. Culkin, one could say that about almost any activity where there's a risk of any kind of danger, right?
I agree with that. And I think that the training for this, look at training a fireman, for example. If you had a bizarre situation where firemen were trained not by the fire department, that's why this case doesn't come up very often, because usually in training programs for dangerous activities, the training is done as an employee. Here, this, for whatever reason, the legislature has delegated to the outfitters the task of training these people and then certifying them, or busting them out if that happens.
The cases that have discussed the essential nature of the service being provided seem to say that it's when there is no other way a consumer can get the particular product or service, and it is essential to their livelihood, if you will.
Yes.
Now, you argue that it's essential to her livelihood because she wanted this job.
To her future, future livelihood.
But the Rowan case that you cite, he was already an employee of the company, was he not?
I think that's a distinction. I guess I'm prone to use cliches, but that's a distinction without a difference.
Why is that?
Because the failure to complete this program and to complete it successfully would have barred her from an entire field of endeavor. It's exactly like, it's a different type of endeavor. It's a very physical type of work, but it's just the same position that all of us were in, at least everyone sitting at the table and you folks behind the bench. It's the same position we were in years ago. You study, you go to law school, you want to be a lawyer. Well, you study, you go to law school, you complete law school successfully, you study for the bar, then you take a rigorous exam, and if you pass it, great. If you don't, you can't be a lawyer. It's exactly the same thing. Think if we were to say, if you didn't sign a contract that would exculpate the law school or the bar exam course from any type of liability for anything they did, you couldn't take the cram course. Would that be appropriate? No. And the fact that it's recreational if you're recreating. You know, if you're engaging in something for fun, it's recreational and it's not clearly not essential under Colorado law. If it's something that, if it's a field of endeavor that you have a right to engage in, if you comply with the appropriate training and the appropriate testing, it is an essential activity because it's something you have a right to choose what you want to do with your life.
Isn't the employer-employee relationship different though, because in Rowan, he wasn't asked to sign the release until the second day after he'd already started engaging in the program. He would have lost his job had he not performed the activity. There was no such limitation here, was there? she had not been hired as a river raft guide, and then only after a day or two of training been asked to sign a release.
It's a different set of facts, but I think the same.
But isn't the compulsion absent? The compulsion in Rowan was sign it or lose your job.
The compulsion in Rowan was the, that was part of the compulsion. But the nexus of Rowan is that there was compulsion. There was compulsion here too. Sign it or don't take the course.
Mr. Culkin, to this point, you've been addressing the third Jones factor. I'm also interested in the fourth Jones factor, clear and unambiguous intent. Could you address that, please?
Yes, if I understand your question, Your Honor, it's the content, it's whether the contents of the exculpatory release reflected the danger to which Ms. Innes would be stricken.
That's right.
Initially, it doesn't describe, the case law always says that it has to describe the activity that they're engaged in, the general activity, not the, every detail of the horse ride, for example. This doesn't describe guides and training activity. This release doesn't. What it describes is it's risks that you're engaged in a commercial rafting avocational adventure.
Can I ask you, Mr. Culkin, on this clear and unambiguous test, isn't the focus on whether the document clearly and unambiguously reflected an intent to have an exculpatory agreement, to have a release, as opposed to it lists all the risks? Obviously needs to give notice, but my understanding of the case is, and please push back if you think I have this wrong, is that we just need to figure out if it's clear and unambiguous that the intent of the parties was to give a release.
Well, it yes and no. That's a lawyerly answer for you.
That's fair enough.
The yes is yes, you have to show a clear intent to release the other party. And this release probably does. But it's also got to describe, at least in general terms, the activity that's going to be engaged in. And in this case, it doesn't describe guides and training. It doesn't tell you where we've got a policy or a tradition, whatever you want to call it, of not pulling people in. We've got a policy of tradition of ignoring the American Canoe Association's guidelines, which would, as our expert said, would have mandated two boats or two trainers. We're going to ignore the state law, which would enable us to allow you to use level three vests, which Mr. Buckdell at least believes would have saved Innes's life. But it describes a different activity. It describes a recreational activity and probably adequately describes those risks. It does not describe either the activity by name, that this is a guides and training program. How hard is it to draft a new release? And I would stress while I'm on the subject, this isn't a decision that would require mandating that the guides in training be given warning of what they're going to be doing. Doesn't affect every person who goes for a river raft ride. It affects a very small number of all the exculpatory releases that are going to be used. Your Honor, I would like to save a little bit of time for rebuttal if I could, but if you want to keep questioning me, have at it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. My name is Brian Molson, Colorado Bar Registration Number 33856. I represent Appalachian Anthony C. Keenan and Kathleen B. Keenan, doing business as Whitewater Adventure Outfitters. I am also should also introduce Peter Middleton, who also represents the Keenans, and Mr. Keenan is in the audience today as well. This appeal finds its genesis in a tragic rafting accident in May of 2010, where Nikki Innes' foot became entrapped and she drowned in the Arkansas River while participating in a rafting guide trainee program offered by the Whitewater Adventure Outfitters. Nikki was not an employee of the Keenans at the time. This particular appeal centers upon the enforceability of a certain exculpatory agreement, both well understood and signed by Nikki prior to her participation in the training program. That agreement was one with which Nikki was extremely familiar. During the prior three whitewater rafting seasons, it was Nikki's job to ensure that all of Keenan's customers had signed the agreement and that all of their questions about the agreement and or the risks associated with rafting were answered.
Well, let me ask you, Mr. Malzahn, it is true that this was the release that Ms. Innes signed is the same release that customers sign who go on a raft trip, correct?
Correct.
There was no special release for folks in training.
Correct.
Is there, and this may not be in the record, is there an industry standard? Are there separate releases for trainees from customers? I mean, it would strike me as a possibility, at least, that there are different risks for a trainee than for just a customer like me who decides to go on a raft trip.
There is nothing in the record about that, Your Honor.
Let me follow up on that and ask you if there are risks that are greater to someone in training than to customers at large when they're going through whitewater rafting training.
I think the activities are different. The risks are the same in the sense that we are talking about, especially here, the idea of being washed overboard, having troubles getting on and off a raft, and drowning in the water, all of which are described in the agreement, which would be given to a regular commercial customer.
Because I thought I had read somewhere that in the case of a customer, for instance, they wouldn't hesitate to pull them out of a raft. And in the case of the trainee, a part of passing and a mandatory part of it is to be able to pull themselves back in the raft. So they do hesitate about pulling them back in.
There is, and it was found by the district court, that the policy was to allow the participants in the rafting trainee program to attempt to pull themselves back in because that is a condition of their becoming certified.
So is that not a greater risk then for the trainees as opposed to the public in general?
It is a different activity. The risk I don't think is any different because we're still talking about being washed overboard, having trouble getting on and off a raft, or drowning.
Okay.
And in terms of the agreement itself, if I can just follow up on that point, the agreement itself is set forth within the record, as you know. It's also within our answer brief. It's not long. It's essentially less than 2 pages. It is devoid of legal jargon, and it specifically addresses unanticipated risks which could result in permanent injury or death. It talks about being a participant being possibly washed overboard. It describes that accidents can occur getting on and off the raft, which is what happened here. And it also describes and discusses the possibility of drowning and death. It also discusses the fallibility of guides who can misjudge a participant's physical ability or the river itself. But it also clearly and unambiguously expresses the intent of the parties to release Keenan's from liability. And in connection with our Supreme Court case in Jones v. Dressel, there are four factors in which the court considers to determine whether such an exculpatory agreement is permitted or found valid and enforceable. The first is whether it involves a public duty, and this one does not. The second is whether it involves an essential service, and this one also does not. And we know that because in Jones v. Dressel, the essential service component was described as being something of great importance to the public. It is undisputed, however, that rafting is not an essential service under Colorado law. It is a recreational activity. Indeed, in Leahy v. Covington, the United States District Court for the District of Colorado held that rafting was not an essential service under Colorado law. It is also true that the nature of a recreational activity like rafting does not change, even when the participant does not undertake the activity as recreation. And for that proposition, we look to Rowan v. Vail Holdings, where the United States District Court for the District of Colorado held that glide test skiing, although not undertaken for recreation by the decedent, was not an essential activity under Colorado law. Similarly, in Brush v. Jiminy Peak Mountain Resorts, the United States District Court for the District of Massachusetts held that the subjective importance of an activity in the life of a participant did not make it an essential activity under Colorado law. Likewise, in Bauer v. Aspen Highland Skiing Corp., the United States District Court for the District of Colorado held that familiarization tours, while perhaps essential, to a travel agent's avocation and success were not essential activities for purposes of Colorado law. And finally, this court in Jones v. Dressel held that it was not essential for the injured plaintiff to pursue his interest in skydiving.
Mr. Molzon, can you cite some examples of what is an essential service?
I'm afraid I might not be able to do that. I have only seen it discussed in the negative.
Let me ask you, Mr. Molzon, while I interrupted you, does it make a difference here that we were talking about a raft guide? I mean, a lot of the cases, you know, testing out the wax on skis strikes me as potentially different than being a guide in a raft, which, you know, you're protecting those, you know, six, eight other people in the raft. Does that make any difference here? You know, for example, if you're the pilot, you know, piloting that skydiving plane, or you're the one who's pushing people out of the door on the skydiving, it would seem to me you would have to know how to do that and make sure that they're ready to jump before you push them out the door. Does it make a difference that what we're talking about is somebody whose job is to protect people?
I don't think so, because I understand the law of Colorado to determine whether or not the activity being addressed in the exculpatory agreement was essential, which our Supreme Court describes as having great importance for the public. Now, while someone may want to be a river rafting guide, if we didn't have them at all, we would still go on and be fine as a state, and we would find other things to do and recreate about. So I don't think so.
Thank you.
Given that river rafting and river raft guide training is not an essential service under Colorado law, this means that Nikki's participation in the training program was necessarily volitional. Because as our Supreme Court again in Jones v. Dressel has declared, if an activity is not essential, a participant has ample and sufficient bargaining power as a matter of law. And this court has echoed that same rule in Hamill versus Chile, Colorado Camps. Moreover, it is undisputed that Nikki could have participated in a different trainee program altogether and still worked for Whitewater Adventure Rafters as she had in the past. With regard to the fourth and final factor, the exculpatory agreement here was clearly and unambiguously expressed the intent of the parties to extinguish liability for Kenan's. First, each and every risk need not be addressed within an exculpatory agreement in order for it to be found valid and enforceable. That proposition finds support in the decision of our Supreme Court in Heil Valley Ranch v. Simpkin, as well as the decision of this court in Hamill, where it was explained that the exculpatory agreements there, quote, did not need to include an exhaustive list of particularized injury scenarios to be effective. That said, the exculpatory agreement here did, in fact, expressly address the risks that led to Nikki's death, as I previously noted. At the end of the day, an exculpatory agreement must clearly and unambiguously express the intention of the parties to extinguish liability. And the exculpatory agreement here did just that, as the court will note within paragraphs 2 and 3 of that agreement. Accordingly, the exculpatory agreement with which Nikki was very familiar and which she signed prior to her participation in the trainee program as a customer of Whitewater Adventure Outfitters is therefore valid and enforceable under Colorado law. And as the Fremont County District Court correctly found, it barred Ennis's action against Kenan's.
Mr. Molzon, can you address the contention, please, that the actions here are willful and wanton that would exclude or that would not be covered, therefore, by the release?
Sure. My first response to that contention is that it's waived. It is waived by virtue of the fact that Ennis's did not amend their complaint to add such allegations or allegations of such conduct.
In part, but here aren't they a defense?
I mean,
excuse me for interrupting. I just didn't want you to move on from that. I fully understand your argument. There were claims here about willful and wanton conduct, but now it comes up. You have raised the defense of release. Don't they get to respond that the release is invalid because there was willful and wanton conduct without amending their complaint? In other words, it's a response to your defense. Why do they have to amend their complaint?
Well, my response to that is the decision in Potter v. National Handicap Sports, where the United States District Court for the District of Colorado held that a similar willful and wanton conduct argument was waived for plaintiff alleged no corresponding allegations within the complaint.
Let's assume it's preserved.
Okay. I was moving on to that. Moreover, I don't believe there's any evidence of any willful conduct here. There was no evidence in the record of any conscious disregard for the safety of Nikki. In fact, the evidence was exactly to the contrary. The record on appeal demonstrates the Keenan's continuing efforts and ensures Nikki's safety by the following: always acting within the customary practice, industry standards, and applicable state regulations, advising Nikki of the dangers of foot entrapment and ways to avoid it, assisting Nikki back into the raft when she first struggled in the water on the second day of training, instructing Nikki repeatedly as to the proper raft reentry techniques, responding immediately to Nikki's request for a different life vest, watching to see that Nikki was successfully reentering the raft on the third day of training before turning attention to another trainee, realizing that Nikki's foot entrapment problem within a couple of seconds thereafter, and taking the quickest action possible in an effort to save Nikki.
Let me ask you, Mr. Molzano, everything you're saying is supported by the record. I get it. Mr. Culkin put on an expert who said, at some level, the opposite. I recognize that you say there was no policy here of not helping somebody back in the boat, and the second day proves that. And Mr. Culkin identified some of the things that the expert referred to about standards in the industry, et cetera. I guess my question to you is, why don't we have a fact question on willful and wanton based on that?
Two things. Number one, I don't think there was any evidence of the record that we were not participating or providing the services in a manner inconsistent with those standards. And secondly, I would also note that Innes's expert did know or opines that any of the conduct he witnessed or is opining upon was willful and wanton. In light thereof, I think the district court was correct in finding that there's no evidence of willful and wanton conduct here as a matter of law.
The asserted policy of not pulling people back into the raft, there's nothing in the record per se that says there was such a policy, but I think Mr. Culkin is relying upon the deposition testimony of the trainer that said, I didn't pull her back in on the third day, essentially.
She did not pull her back in on the third day because when she saw Nikki coming into the raft, she realized that it was another movement of her person and she was into the raft and thought Nikki had done so. So there was no need in her mind to pull her in. She wasn't struggling at that point to get in the raft. She was actually entering the raft successfully. I see that my time's running out. I would simply close by saying, on behalf of Anthony and Kathleen Keenan, we would request that the Fremont County District Court's entry of summary judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Initially, just to address the issue of the tradition, as Mr. Bucktel, our expert, said, or the policy, as I've said, of not pulling people back in. This is a CD 316 Keenan deposition 47:13-20. Couldn't a second guide have pulled Nikki in? Wouldn't have. She was halfway in the boat already, and I imagine, like Cotto, that's Kirkman, thought one movement she is going to be in. The whole idea is trainees get back in the boat. Then he was asked at CD 315 Keenan Depot 48:17, question, if she had not been a trainee and they were going over the hole and a second instructor was in the boat, would a second instructor have pulled her in? Mr. Middleton, objection to form foundation and speculation. Mr. Culkin, go ahead. The deponent, Mr. Keenan, you always pull customers in. It is protocol to pull customers. Whether they are trying to get in the boat, you always grab them and pull them in. But trainees are a different animal. You want to learn to pull themselves back in the boat. If you read Mr. Bucktel's deposition, he is a person who is an honest man. He says he's not a lawyer. He's an expert in rafting. Defendants themselves say he's the leading expert in whitewater safety. He came to the conclusion, based on reading of the depositions, that there was a tradition as or a policy, whatever you want to call it, of not pulling the trainees in. This put Ms. Innes at a much greater risk, and it eventually led to her death. Since I have 4 seconds.
Actually, you're way over, Mr. Culkin.
I apologize, Your Honor, and thank you very much for your attention this morning.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. As soon